ebook publishers and marketing services company, Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $14.99 per month, that's Downpour.com. On this episode, after years of wandering, poet Ruth Nolan brings the light of the Mojave Desert. Sergio Magana explains the dawn of the sixth sun, and this audiobook feature will leave you in shock and awe.
I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
And I'm Lucia Sherman. Here's a look at our top stories of the art and entertainment world. Les Miserables is the motion picture adaptation of the most beloved global stage sensation, seen by more than 60 million people in 42 countries and in 21 languages, is still breaking box office records everywhere in its 27th year. Helmed by the King's Speech Academy Award-winning director Tom Hooper, the working title Cameron Mackintosh production stars Hugh Jackman, Oscar winner Russell Crowe, Anne Hathaway, Amanda Seyfried, Helena Bonham Carter, and Sacha Baron Cohen, and others. Set against the backdrop of 19th century France, Les Mis tells an enthralling story of broken dreams and unrequited love, passion, sacrifice, and redemption, and is a timeless testament to the survival of the human spirit. Jackman plays ex-prisoner Jean Valjean, hunted for decades by the ruthless policeman Javert after he breaks parole. When Valjean agrees to care for factory worker Fantine's young daughter Cosette, their lives change forever. In December 2012, the world's longest-running musical brings its power to the big screen in Tom Hooper's sweeping and spectacular interpretation of Victor Hugo's epic tale. With international superstars and beloved songs, Les Mis, the show of shows, is now reborn as a cinematic musical experience of a lifetime. You know, I saw this show years and years and years ago at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in L.A., the stage production, and it was fantastic. It left me almost breathless. It's a wonderful story, and the production quality was sterling. Have you seen it?
No. I haven't seen any of the plays. I've seen, there's been a couple movies. I've seen both the movies. One with Liam Neeson, who I believe we have a story about later on. He was in the one that I saw with Uma Thurman. And it was a great movie, too. And I'm really looking forward to this one because I saw the trailer on, not the movie trailer itself, I saw that, but the directors came on and did a whole synopsis of how they filmed this. And what they did was they wanted to keep it true to form. Like when you do you're a director, Lucia, so you know when you're directing, right? When you're doing a musical, usually you cut in the songs, you dub them in.
Right.
And they lip sync to them. Well, in this movie, they did not. Everyone singing is live. Every scene is done.
Wow.
Yeah,
every scene is
live.
Good for them.
When they're singing, you know, when Anne Hathaway is singing and she's in the rain, she's in the rain, and she was talking about it. She goes, yeah, I was in that rain for like 8 hours doing this song.
Oh my gosh.
Hugh Jackman, all of them were, every single scene in the movie is done live.
Well, Tom Hooper is a wonderful director, and that doesn't surprise me that he would do that, to get the feel, the emotion of the place and the characters.
I mean, yeah, that's what he was going after, to get the feel, the emotion, and spontaneity that you only get from live production.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing that kind of blew me away was that all these different, and they're big name actresses and actors.
Absolutely.
That they all could sing.
Multi-talented.
I'd love to see Russell Crowe singing. He sings in the film?
He does.
Oh, my goodness. Really?
He sings, Hugh Jackman sings, Anne Hathaway sings. And
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw the trailer, too. It looked really great when we went saw Cloud Atlas, Charlie.
Yeah, Cloud Atlas. I love that movie.
Yeah, and then you sent me that link with Tom Hanks, who stars in a movie, doing a recent appearance where he delivers a passionate, thought-provoking, beat-style poem about Full House.
I love Tom Hanks as an actor, but I love him as a beat poet. Man, I've got to hear some of this.
Let's hear it.
Let's do it.
It sounds good.
Full House. House full of men, Danny, Jesse, Joey, father, uncle, friend. Uncle Jesse, whose hair is never messy. Watch the hair, huh? Have mercy on Uncle Jesse.
Well, speaking of good entertainment, have you heard of the new TV show called Revolution?
Yes, I have. Tell me about it.
I've actually seen a couple of the shows. They're pretty good.
Yeah, it's the latest project by J.J. Abrams. And even though the initial reviews weren't stellar across the board, this new series has been racking up fairly decent ratings since it started this fall. In fact, NBC has already ordered a full series commitment to the show. Jennifer Salk, president of NBC Entertainment, said, "We're impressed with the imagination and the creative direction of the entire team on Revolution, not to mention the immediately strong response we got from the audience." Indeed, according to reports, Revolution had the biggest drama premiere for NBC in 5 years.
Wow, that's big.
Yeah. Almost 12 million people tuned in for the show's debut, and it got a lot of help coming on after The Voice. And indeed, it has shown surprising staying power with a 10 million viewer average. That's a lot.
Yeah, you know, I saw the show, and I didn't even really, you know, I know there was a lot of hype behind it, you know, and I don't watch The Voice. I must be like the only person in America that doesn't watch
either.
It.
I don't either.
Come clean.
Yeah. I mean, it just, you know, The Voice just doesn't do it for me. I mean, but I know all my kids love it, but, you know, and I just doesn't do it for me. But I just happened to, you know, to click on and Revolution was on. I'm like, oh, yeah, this new show's coming on, right? So I watched it and it was pretty dang good. It was a good storyline, and it was better than most of the stuff that you see on TV, which kind of explains why they're the most popular show right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's still the number one show in its time frame, which beats out Castle and Hawaii Five-0.
Dun, 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 dun,
shows
dun,
dun, something.
It's a new Hawaii Five-0 show. It's a new one.
Well, it's all definitely good news for J.J. Abrams, who already saw one series come and go this year, Alcatraz. I hadn't even heard of it.
No.
But overall, it hasn't actually been a very easy year for genre TV. But so far, Revolution, it's showing strong signs of life.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like a futuristic.
Well, J.J. Abrams, I actually saw him do a TED Talk.
Love those TED Talks.
Yeah, me too. And he was...
What is a TED Talk?
Oh, they're the
really
best.
Interesting,
really?
Inspiring.
Do you know what a TED Talk is,
yes.
Cyrus?
I've seen it, yeah.
You really?
Did? Yep.
Man, I got to get out more.
Yeah, and J.J. Abrams, he was talking about, it's kind of like bringing inspiration.
Scientific, humanitarian.
Every topic.
Every topic, but people that are on the cutting edge of greatness in their fields, yeah.
And really? Bringing in their own personal message, because in this video that I saw, J.J. Abrams was talking about how much he loves his grandfather and how much he was inspired by him, and he got him really inspired.
Who does it? Who does the TED Talks? I mean, what is it?
Different
what does
people.
It stand for?
All sorts of different people.
Technology, entertainment, design is what TED stands for.
Oh my gosh!
Oh,
how did you?
You're
learn
brilliant.
That?
You're channeling.
Well, because you know, I just remember because like technology, entertainment, and design. That's right. I got an email from them. They wanted to talk to me.
Right.
I didn't know what the whole deal was about, you know. So.
Yeah, J.J. Abrams. He also did Super 8. I just saw that the other day. Pretty good movie.
Super 8.
Yeah, Steven Spielberg produced it. It's kind of set back in like the 60s or 70s. It's just, you know, it's a classic kids thing, you know, almost like Stand By Me, except for there's a huge train wreck.
Oh, that's the thing. I saw a trailer for that. That's
yeah,
right.
It's really good, yeah.
We'll wonder no more about what film every couple will want to see together on Valentine's Day in 2013.
Ted, the movie.
No. It's called Safe Haven, the latest weepy from Nicholas Sparks. Weepy. That's an interesting word. Don't cry, Maya.
You know that Nicholas Sparks, man. I mean, you know, he is like some popular dude with the ladies.
Ladies.
Yeah, he is. Mm-hmm. And he's very he has
a spark.
Yes, he
What was that other big book he had out last year? Some huge book. They made it into a movie.
He's a director.
He's also a writer. He writes all the books.
The fourth adaptation of a Sparks novel in 3 years focuses on a young woman played by Julianne Hough who runs away from a dangerous predicament in Boston and into the arms of a sturdy single dad played by Josh Duhamel who lives in a quiet seaside town. But the question is, will they fall in love? Of course, but without the help of a friendly neighbor, a rainstorm, and the cover of the Fleetwood Mac hit, Go Your Own Way. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I love that song.
I love that song.
I love that song.
Oh, that was before my time.
It's so weird. Just the other day, I was listening and watching some videos from Fleetwood Mac.
I met Mick Fleetwood.
When?
I met him in 1979, almost 1980.
How'd you meet him?
He was at my house.
What were you guys up to?
It was really, really trippy because we were having a garage sale at our house. We lived in Los Angeles, and he and his girlfriend came walking up.
Oh my gosh!
And I recognized him from
the
album.
Was it Christine McVie?
I didn't recognize her.
Okay. I don't know. Wasn't she involved with one of the?
She was married to the guitar player.
Oh, the guitar player?
Lindsey Buckingham.
She was married to Lindsey Buckingham?
No, she
was
not.
No, that was...
One of those blondes was married to... That was... what's her name? Stevie Nicks.
She
was married to Lindsey Buckingham.
Yeah, okay.
And Christy McVie was married to the bass player.
Oh,
and okay. Mick Fleetwood was hanging out at my house at the garage sale.
So what did he buy at your garage sale?
Yeah. He bought absolutely nothing.
Oh.
But he did sign a couple autographs.
He did, I bet. And was it on one of his albums?
No. You know, it was really trippy because, you know, I didn't even recognize him at first. He's just a guy with long hair and a beard.
And he's going to garage sales?
Yeah, well, we live in a nice neighborhood.
That's cool. Well, wow. Well, you know, garage sales are pretty fun.
They are. It's my passion.
I know. Maya and I have talked about that before. But before you write off Safe Haven as another pre-manufactured romantic hit, take note. Lasse Hallström, known for The Cider House Rules and Chocolat, is the director, and this guy has 3 Oscar nominations. The film is out on February 8th, 2013.
Can't wait to see that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I love Chocolat and...
I love that film.
Yeah, that was great. You know,
it was a very romantic film.
Yeah, it was really good. And, you know, I mean, like when I first saw it, you know, they got so much billing, but Johnny Depp was in it. Like, but he had a very small part in that movie. What was that other film that he directed?
Oh, it's Cider House Rules, which
I love Cider House Rules.
That was a great film, too.
That was a great book.
I wonder if Newsweek will cover that.
You know,
Newsweek.
I hear there's some news about Newsweek.
There is some fantastic news about Newsweek, in my opinion. And Cyrus is going to tell us all about it, aren't you, Cy?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, they're definitely they're making a transition right now. After years of losing money, they've announced that they're going to stop printing the magazine and become a digital-only publication. Editor Tina Brown wrote an email to employees, as part of the transition, the last print edition will be December 31st, so that's coming up pretty soon. The new all-digital publication called Newsweek Global will be a single worldwide edition. The e-magazine will be supported by paid subscriptions and made available for e-readers for both tablet and the web, with some content available on the Daily Beast. So, yeah, it'll be available there. But, of course, the tablets and all that we're very used to. We've covered the Amazon Kindle Fires and all that. So, you know, you'll be able to get Newsweek there. Their editor, Brown, she was the former editor of Vanity Fair and a New Yorker and has put her stamp on Newsweek by producing controversial print covers like imagining what Princess Diana would have looked like at age 50.
Wow.
What she says is by creating these controversial covers and stories, she creates a buzz, which she likes to call the conversation, and gets people involved in this story talking about it. So
kind of like Ted.
Kind of like Ted. Yeah.
But you know that actually makes a lot of sense. And it's just, as I've said many, many times before on this program, it's just everybody's still doing the same thing. They were just doing it, you know, we're getting there in a different vehicle because yellow journalism, which is pretty much what, you know, those covers are, is what, you know, shocks you into like, yeah, I got to pick up a copy of that. And You know, that the fact that it's on digital is even better, because pretty sure all you guys were pretty green there, and I'm thinking it's going to save a lot of trees.
Oh, well.
Yes.
Yeah. It's interesting how it's kind of like the shock value is needed for sales these days. Like, how far are we going to go in terms of, like, you know, as raunchy as this, in order to grab people's attention and make them want to read it.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but that's the thing, because it really goes back to, you know, basic human instincts, you know. So if you see a cover, like, okay, here's the classic example in our country, the USA. I buy Playboy for the articles.
You're revealing a lot to the listeners right now.
Yeah, there's just so much out there, you know, we're just saturated with it, that it really does take a lot to get our attention, I guess.
I know. Going back to the Revolution television series, that series is based upon the premise that they've lost power. The whole world has lost power.
Right.
Or maybe it's the United States. I think it's the world, right? And so there's no electricity. And so that brings you back to, what if, you know, something happened to this world, like a comet or something hitting the planet, mm-hmm. and we have no electricity? We're going to get back to the basics. And that's why I think the premise of Revolution is so interesting, because it's a possibility. Yeah. I'm not the Mayan calendar 2012
well, coming
to
an
end. Yes,
you know,
like, I don't prescribe to that.
That's another reason why movies like The Hunger Game and the books you know, are such a success, is because it kind of taps into that and kind of gives people an idea or something to imagine of what it could turn into.
Yeah,
and I think that's what, you know, like with Cloud Atlas, which I thought was a fine film. But, you know, the thing is with the Cloud Atlas is, like, it didn't have the following that a Hunger Games or, you know, a Harry Potter has. Because everyone was so immersed in the books and the stories that they were waiting to go see this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think, you know, you're right that, you know, we still are going to be reading. And but I do like the digital age, you know. I mean, much as I enjoyed, you know, the drawing, you know, drawings on the cave wall.
Well, remember when 40-year-olds used to be considered over the hill?
No.
No.
Do you sorry?
Well, they say 40 is the new 50 or something, right?
Yeah, it could be a little different these days. A rapper, Eminem, is proving that wrong. He turned the big 4-0 last month.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he did. Can you believe it? And he has 61 million likes on Facebook. He's popular.
Huge.
Most popular person on the social networking site until recently, when Rihanna took the lead spot. But that's not bad.
For 61 million. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of likes.
Honestly, this Lose Yourself rapper is still in demand. It's been 2 years since he released his latest album, Recovery, and his fans are excited about the still untitled 8th album, which is due out next year, 2013. And music aside, M's real fans know that fatherhood is his biggest priority.
Aww.
Yeah. And even back when he was only 29, you know, about a decade ago, he said he was still doing the best he could to raise his daughter, Haley. He said, I'm a father before anything.
I didn't even know he was a priest.
Those were his earlier days.
But you know, that kind of makes sense. We got 61 million followers, you know?
Yeah, that's right. I'm a father before I pick up the mic, he said. I'm a father before I'm Eminem. Of course, I'm not the perfect parent. There may be things I'm doing wrong, and I'll find it in 10 or 15 years. But right now, I'm doing the best job I can, and that's all I can do.
Good for him.
Yeah.
So Haley turns 17 next month.
Wow.
And she's been referenced in nearly a dozen tracks. When she was 6, she actually co-wrote and performed the chorus for the song My Dad's Gone Crazy. And she has siblings, since Eminem also has 3 adopted kids. His ex-wife Kimberly Scott's child from another relationship, a niece from her side of the family, and his youngest half-brother. M credits his kids with helping him overcome his drug addiction and even a suicide attempt.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's pretty moving. Eminem revealed an interesting fact about his parenting style during a 2010 interview on 60 Minutes. Despite his excessive use of explicit language in his music, he said his home is actually a curse-free zone.
Amazing. Yeah. I would never expect that from...
What
yeah, so he doesn't say it at home, but it certainly is in his music. My friend Joey Danger, he pointed out to me that Eminem had a feud with Moby, the other musician, about 10 years ago, and it evoked really nasty lyrics from both of them. And I looked it up, and indeed, you know, even though he doesn't like cursing around the house in front of his kids, his songs certainly have it. You 36-year-old bald-headed blank, blow me, you don't know me, you're too old. Which is, it's funny, you're too old at that time. 36 was old. And now, look, Eminem is 40.
There you go.
Yeah, you know.
The Beatles, doesn't it remind you of the Beatles?
Yeah, it does.
Say, don't trust anyone over 30.
Yeah, never trust anybody over 30. You know, the Eminem not cursing in his house thing is really kind of cool. You know, I have a lot of children and try not to curse around them. It happens, you know, and it always reminds me of this movie, since we're coming up at the holidays, but, you know, the Christmas Story. And in the movie.
Oh, I love that movie.
You know, the Ralphie, the kid, you know, gets his mouth washed up with soap for using the F word.
And
yeah. And his mom is saying, where did you hear that? And then in the narration, he goes, now, my old man worked in profanity the way Picasso worked in oils.
That's a good line. Yeah.
Oh, fudge. Yeah.
You know, and you don't even think about that, because then when they never in the movie, they never show him cussing. Well, you hear him down in the basement, you know, having, you know, a fit with the furnace. You know, it's so cool that Eminem, you know, sets a good example for his kids. You know, and I think you find as you get older that that's what you need to do. And here's a guy that used to cuss up a storm. I mean, really cuss up a storm big time.
Who are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about Eddie Murphy.
Oh.
You know, and if you'd see, you know, any of his shows live, you know, one day he was famous for Delirious and
Raw.
And Raw. I mean, you know, I remember he had a big tiff going on with Bill Cosby, who we went and saw this summer at the Brit Festival. Very good. Mm-hmm. About, you know, Bill Cosby says, I like Eddie Murphy. He's so funny, but I don't know why he needs to curse so much, which is really kind of true of a lot of comedians, because if you take out their curse words, you know, they're just as funny.
Sarah Silverman.
Yeah, she's funny.
Really funny.
She's hilarious.
Yeah, she's really funny, and she has great timing. But
well, maybe when Sarah Silverman gets older, they'll be giving her awards and honoring her. Arsenio Hall, Russell Brand, Tracy Morgan, Adam Sandler, Jamie Foxx, Chris Rock, and many, many others recently teamed together to pay tribute to Eddie Murphy. The highlight was the comedian's duet with Stevie Wonder of the 1973 hit Higher Ground. During the taping of the Spike TV special, Eddie Murphy, One Night Only. I saw a movie that he recently did called 1,000 Words, and it was great. It was all about a guy that, you know, cusses too much and talks too much. Anyway, he does, you know, a lot more wholesome things now. And he's, you know, he's been in Shrek. He's been in Dreamgirls. You know, he's, the recent movie is 1,000 Words. And he was accompanied by a pretty young blonde to the taping of the Eddie Murphy One Night Only. It's set to air on November 14th. And the Roots, which is the band from Jimmy Fallon, they were the house band.
They can be funny. They can bring comedy in.
Now, you know, I want to watch it just to see this, because Tracy Morgan called Murphy his comic hero, and he came on stage wearing a replica of Eddie Murphy's red leather suit from his stand-up show, Delirious. I loved that when Delirious first came out, and I still, to this day, will laugh at that routine about the ice cream man. He was also in The Nutty Professor, and he was one of the cast members on Saturday Night Live. He was Gumby, damn it.
I loved him in The Nutty Professor. I loved him. He was wonderful in that. And he was really funny, and he played all those different roles, especially around the dinner table. Do you remember that? When he was all those different characters in the family?
Oh, yeah, when he was
or
on
maybe that. It was Nutty Professor 2. I don't know, but...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're talking about the clumps and the Nutty Professor when he played all the different roles?
Yeah.
When he was a man and he was a woman?
Yeah. And his grandma.
Does his talent know no bounds?
I know. He was terrific.
You know, I like, you know, the way he's talking about it. He said, you know, I'm just a retired old song and dance man. Adding that he only makes rare appearances these days. Then I'm like, Eddie Dowd, man. You know, what would really be great is that if Eddie Murphy came up here and made a film here in Ashland, because they make so many films up here.
They do, don't they?
They sure do.
Award-winning actors are in Southern Oregon shooting scenes for a feature film coming this summer. Crew members are at Mountain Meadows Community filming Redwood Highway. Twice nominated for an Academy Award and two-time Emmy winner Shirley Knight plays a strong-willed woman who decides to walk 80 miles. 80? Can you believe that? 80 miles from Grants Pass to the Oregon coast. I don't know if I could do that.
Did she hit 80 miles?
Did she hitchhike? Really?
I don't know if it's a true story or not, but anyway.
They did walk.
They're not wearing heels.
From the East Coast to the West Coast.
I know, that's true. Nice shoes.
Gotta have good shoes.
She wasn't wearing platform high heels.
The producer, James Twyman, says the retirement center in Ashland will be filmed as if it were in Grants Pass. The film will feature all the beautiful areas of Southern Oregon, such as the Redwood Highway, its namesake, downtown Grants Pass, Cave Junction, and Lake Selmec. I think it has a lot to do with the energy of the Rogue Valley, he says. It's a special place, and those of us who live here know that. I know that. How about you guys?
Oh, definitely.
Oh, it's so pretty here.
Yeah, I heard it on Tubbs.
You did not. But I think maybe Hollywood and independent film in general is beginning to notice that as well. If that continues, we're going to see a lot more of this, he added. Other characters featured in the film include local actors from the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and most of the crew members also live in Southern Oregon. Producers are hoping to film in the Southern Oregon area for 3 days and then head out to the coast to shoot more footage. Redwood Highway will be released nationwide this summer.
You know what? I can't wait to see that. And it's so cool, you know, that you can see it. Like, you know, I went down on the set when Lucia was shooting her film. And it's so cool. I mean, like, you know, we're on the streets here of our small little picturesque town, and there's this, you know, director and all the cameras and the crew and the grips and the actors, and you're like, wow, dude, this is pretty cool.
It's so common when you live in Los Angeles, you see film crews everywhere just shooting, you know, willy-nilly. But in Ashland, it's kind of, you know, I mean, they're starting to come more and more. So, but it's really fun when I see a...
Well, yeah, that's
a crew
that's
out there.
I mean, I've seen a lot of film sets in New York, you know, and you know, people filming and stuff.
Yeah.
But in Ashland, you know, it's a when I saw you guys filming, you know, I mean, the whole scene is already so picturesque. I was like, oh my gosh!
Ooh, I can't wait to
like,
see
it's
it.
It's like building a, you know, like in L.A. or New York, they would have to build a set like that to get it to look that way.
And the really cool thing about filming in Ashland is that they don't charge you, they don't tax you for filming on the street. If you're shooting in a like Portland or Los Angeles or New York, you're going to get charged a lot of money for shutting the street down and the whole thing. So, you know, I think that's what a lot of filmmakers like about Southern Oregon, because it's a lot less expensive than it was for us.
So, yeah, going from Southern Oregon to Northern California, where Skywalker Ranch is in the Redwoods, Disney's going to pay $4 billion for it, and Lucasfilm LTD, they're going to buy it from the chairman and founder, George Lucas. Then they're going to go on and make the seventh movie in the Star Wars series called Episode 7, appropriately, which will be released in 2015, with plans to follow it up with Episode 8 and 9, and then one movie every 2 or 3 years, kind of like the James Bond series. The Walt Disney Company announced the blockbuster agreement to make the purchase. The deal includes Lucasfilm's prized high-technology production companies like Skywalker Ranch, Industrial Light and Magic, and also the rights to the Indiana Jones franchise. So,
you know,
quite a deal.
You know, I never thought that he would give that up.
It surprises me that he's doing that.
Yeah. Well, he went on to say that it's time for him to pass on the Star Wars franchise to a new generation of filmmakers.
You know, a lot of people will just, you know, will keep doing something, you know, not like an athlete, not knowing when it's time to retire. You know, like the old thing about the boxer, you know, he should have retired, you know, 3 or 4 years ago from, you know, when he was in his prime. And he sounds like he's just saying, I've taken it as far as I can go, but I think there's more out there, but someone else is going to have to come up with the ideas.
Fresh ideas, fresh point of view.
And a good correlation, like the thing with the, you know, James Bond. But I didn't think he would... he would give it up. And it's really interesting about Star Wars. If you notice that Star Wars, the first movie they released was number 4, actually.
I knew that. Which is really trippy. I know.
Well, it's interesting because on Facebook, all of a sudden I saw all these posts of people who were, you know, totally in protest. And I was like, well, I guess people have attachment and, you know, the thinking that Disney is going to do a certain something with it. And
so, instead of the Lucas feel.
But I guess my generation has a special attachment to the faithful.
Well, you know, if Disney keeps true to form, they're just going to own it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like when they bought Pixar, they don't mix with Pixar. Pixar does their own stuff, their own productions.
That's true. I have a feeling that he's not going to retire. I have a feeling he has something else under his sleeve.
Yeah, you know what? Okay. George Lucas retiring, which is basically what he's doing. He's saying he'll work on some more films, you know. It's kind of shocking news. But you know what? There is more shocking news than that.
Well, just wait, you guys. Liam Neeson did a dramatic reading of Justin Bieber's Boyfriend, and we didn't even know about it.
Oh, shut the front door.
Yeah, way, way back in September.
We gotta hear a little bit of that. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Okay.
Baby, take a chance, or you'll never, ever know. I got money in my hands that I'd really like to blow.
Liam Neeson has been around for so long, I never thought I would be seeing him do something like this with Justin Bieber, the young son.
You know, he has been around a long time, and you know, you forget that he can do you know, comedy, and he does it very well. And as we've just heard from that, you know, dramatic reading, he's got quite a singing career ahead of him. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you, somebody who doesn't have a singing career ahead of him but does have continue to have a great film career is Quentin Tarantino. And two of his acclaimed works, Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, each will be in theaters for one night only this December. They're calling it Tarantino 20. Reservoir Dogs' 20th anniversary event will hit selected movie theaters nationwide on Tuesday, December 4th at 7 p.m. local time. And that's in the USA. And Tarantino's 20 Pulp Fiction event will follow 2 days later on Thursday, December 6th at 7 p.m. local time with matinees in selected markets. Each cinema will include a special feature showcasing Tarantino's 20-year career and a selection of hand-picked movie trailers from films that inspired him as a filmmaker. You know, I got to say that, you know, he's a great director, and I really don't know too many people who have not seen Pulp Fiction, although Reservoir Dogs is something that, you know, kind of got him started, but Pulp Fiction really put him on the map with Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah.
And everybody knows all the dialogue from Pulp Fiction, and I can't believe that it's been out for 20 years.
Oh, yeah. I guess so. 20 years.
Yeah, huh. And Bruce Willis was in there, too. I remember he was in there. You know, it's just, there's one thing about Pulp Fiction that I really have never quite figured out. And, you know, it's one of those movies that you see and you have to see it again because you're still scratching your head, like, what's going on? Because they splice in 3-4 different movies all together.
Yeah.
Storylines, which he's tried, you know, unsuccessfully in other films to do. But
He got it perfectly in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, and yeah. He wrote and directed the thing himself.
I know.
There was no other writer on that. He wrote all the dialogue.
Yeah. That's pretty impressive.
It's really impressive. I mean, right out of the gate, you know, to have your masterpiece right there.
I know.
And the thing about, you know, in the movie Pulp Fiction is like they always are going around with that case, Marcellus Wallace's case, right? They got to get that case back. And they always open that case, but they never show you what's in it. So the thing is, maybe they'll show one of these, the trailer
maybe
things.
Maybe we'll find out.
Yeah, because I've heard so many different theories about, you know, was it drugs? Was it gold?
Right.
Was it, you know, the secret to life, you know?
But that's what's so brilliant about that film, is you always wondered what was in the case.
Yeah, I guess Quentin Tarantino said he will never reveal what it was. So
I guess we'll have to leave it to our imagination. And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Blackstone's special feature.
Poet and college professor Ruth Nolan shared her literary desert knowledge with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of Get Behind Me, Not Stay There. Today, we're very privileged to have with us Ruth Nolan. She's an author, a poet. Of course, you all know that. And she works on several projects that we're going to get into a little bit. And welcome, Ruth.
Welcome. Hi. Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Of course. Thank you.
So, you know, we've talked a lot about you, you know, your work, and we actually did an interview with Marion from the Atlanta Institute, and she had, like, you know, nothing but, you know, just all these praises to say about you. And now we finally get to, you know, meet you and interview you, and it's such a treat for us. And so we'd like to, you know, just hear a little bit about, you know, what you're working on right now. Tell us a little bit about your book, No Place for a Puritan, which is a great title, by the way. You know, the only title I could think of that's better is Skip Home, You Not Stay There. But you know. Maybe I'm a little prejudiced with that, eh?
Well, I consider myself basically a California writer. I'm a native of California and primarily focusing on the inland areas. Born in San Bernardino, raised in the Mojave Desert, worked as a firefighter for the BLM, doing hotshot helicopter work, and just spent most of my adult life until the last 5 or 6 years just basically wandering out in the desert, metaphorically and literally.
Oh, okay. So there was a famous guy that would wandered out in the desert for a lot of years. A lot of people talk about him. Right? Who he was.
Oh. Well, and
his name wasn't Joshua, but it was really close.
Yeah, huh? It was Ruth.
Oh. Yes, it was Ruth. Yeah, Joshua's sister, younger sister Ruth.
From the Bible.
Yeah.
So I primarily, I write in all genres. I primarily have been publishing poetry, but I'm making a kind of a leap into prose and feature something known as, that's been coined cultural journalism for KCET Artbound Los Angeles, which is a new project coordinated by KCET in Southern California to feature cultural arts pieces by different writers, journalists, artists, people in throughout Central and Southern California.
Yeah, KCET, they're pretty big. You know, I remember, you know, they're always... They always had these really, you know, cool projects going on when I was living in Los Angeles, and they would, you know, I'd always see their magazine articles. And back then, when people had TV guides, there was always stuff about that.
They've totally switched into the, you know, online platform blogging, and they are planning to make some of the columns. I'm not sure if mine will be, but they're actually starting a TV series.
Oh, cool!
So they're going to feature shows also. So that's something that I'm kind of really excited about that I just started doing. About my book, No Place for a Puritan, I compiled that because I'm a professor over at College of the Desert near Palm Springs, and I teach there. I focus on desert literature and creative writing, and I wanted my students to have a collected reader of good literary works that were also accessible and, you know, not too hard to read.
Right.
So stuff that just really would come to represent and, you know, show them a little bit about where they live. And so I put this together. This was actually a sort of a sequel to the book Inlandia, which is about Riverside, San Bernardino. And that was tied in with the Inlandia Institute, which you already mentioned.
Right.
And so I offered to do this next book and put this together. And it's gotten a lot of good critical feedback. And the title actually came from a poem, one of the poems in the book.
Oh.
And this poem was written by a man who went to World War II. He was served, came home, and he spent a year wandering in Death Valley. And he wrote this whole book of poetry.
Death Valley.
Can you believe that? And then he went on to become a famous wallpaper designer in San Francisco.
I heard something
so
about
that. So it's really crazy.
I don't mean to
go ahead.
Take up your train of thought, but no, I'd heard something about Death Valley, about how, you know, hey, it doesn't describe the place. It's not a Death Valley. It's just what the settlers coming through on the covered wagons would call it or something like
it's
that.
It's fascinating that you say that because I actually have a piece in this book that is the Shoshone Indian Homeland Statement from the Shoshone, Timbisha Shoshone of Death Valley Elder Pauline Estevez. And that tribe had to fight for 50 years just to get tribal recognition. And then some of their lands have been repatriated to them. And so in the piece that I have in this book where she was testifying to Congress about who they are and what their homeland is, she actually says that they don't like the name Death Valley. That's an unfortunate name that was given by the white settlers, you know, the famous story, the William Lewis Manley story. And she said, this is just so classic. She said, all they had to do was ask us where the water was. So doesn't that just put a whole different spin on lot of,
you know, really, but
the westward
really,
movement
it does, but I guess it would, you know, I mean, if you're, you know, in extreme heat and you don't know where the water is, I guess it would kind of feel like a death
It valley. Wasn't the hot time of year when they went through there.
Every That's, time you know, is a hot time of year. There.
Well, I guess if you're from here. But, and they also, the Shoshone call it Tupa'a. It's named after one of the red clays that are in the mountain.
Oh, okay.
So in their view, that actually means place of life. So the Native American name of the place is completely diametrically different to what the Anglo people named it when they came through.
Right, just two different points of view.
very vastly different points of view. And I don't know, that just somehow just speaks so much about just cultural differences. And, you know, our country's moving towards sustainable, renewable types of living. And so you think, wow, you know, that people would think about things like that, you know, like how do you live in a place without, you know, going through it and not really understanding where you're at.
Right. You know, and it, it's, you know, like nowadays, you know, we have, you know, so much technology that, you know, you can live anywhere. You can live on the moon. It doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. You know, we can do that. But back then, you know, a couple hundred years ago, you know, you really had to have your wits about you.
Yeah.
You know, and you had to really be in touch with, you know, with nature and,
yeah,
and you know, what's going on, or you just didn't make it very long.
Right. It was very difficult. But I think Native American people pretty much have had it down. And I think it's really neat that there's a lot of movement towards going back, you know, to renewing a lot of revival or renewal of Native American knowledge and plant usage. And culture, I think that's really important for our
survival, basically. No, I've noticed that, you know, and a lot of it, you know, to me, I'm just a simpleton from the Pacific Northwest. I'm just like, you know, yeah, you know, it's like, you know, technology, we've got all this new technology and, you know, all these things. And what they come up with is, yeah, you know what? I think we need to go back to mm-hmm. a simpler time when, because, you know, it obviously worked.
Right. Like the dam removal up here in the Northwest, the removal of dams and the restoration of salmon. I mean, we need more of that.
So, you know, your book,
mm-hmm.
it's published by Heyday Books.
Mm-hmm.
Good outfit, really good outfit.
Well, the book I've done for Heyday is it's a collected anthology of pieces from Native American early history to contemporary writers. So it's a lot of different writers. And I do have one poem in there.
I know you're a poet. And, you know, why don't you read us, you know, a poem?
Okay.
And
I'm happy to.
And maybe you can tell us a little bit about it.
I have a poem.
Okay.
It's called Mirage. And all my poems are based on true stories, pretty much, even though they're very surreal.
Uh-huh.
So this one, there's a lot of really, really amazing places in the desert where I've spent time. This one's called Mirage, and it actually is based on a true story that took place. Kelso Sand Dunes, which is in the East Mojave Preserve. My 10-year-old daughter is feeling brave, so we go rock hunting today, exploring far beyond the last dirt road. Just she and I, no dad. We see the sand dunes from miles away. Some hallucinogenic scene from the Sahara. Camel humps rising from the flat desert floor. My daughter wants to climb them, but there's no sure way to guess how far away they are. No sure measure to tell how tall. I tell her it's not safe to hike mountains, so unstable. Hills that shift in light winds. Our boots would fill with sand, and we'd sink like thirsty prospectors, come to find buried treasure, lured by promises of silver and gold, the rattlesnake's hypnotic charms.
Wow, I like that.
Thank you. And
I want to tell you it's been a pleasure having you on. And everyone, you can go to Ruth Nolan's Facebook page. Is it just Ruth Nolan?
Ruth Nolan, or, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Ruth Nolan's on Facebook page and your blog spot.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be a link on justimagineinc.com. And there'll be a YouTube video as well. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, you know, we just really enjoyed having you on. And next time you're in the Ashland area, we'd love to have you come back again.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you, too.
To learn more about Ruth Nolan, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
This is the end, beautiful friend.
Everyone's been talking about the Mayan calendar and the end of the world with December 21st in 2012. Well, Sergio Magana, one of the guardians of the Aztec tradition, explained these legends in the studio with myself and Cyrus Emerson.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today we have Sergio Magana, author of The Dawn of the Sixth Sun. And he's here with us in the studios today. How are you doing, Sergio?
Very good. Very happy being here in Ashland. Thank you.
Nice. So you just got done doing a workshop today, right?
Yeah, we were teaching here, dreaming that it's like our specialty in Mexico. I'm Mexican, by the way. So, yeah, Mexico is an old word from Nahuatl that means the place of the navel of the moon. So our specialty is dreaming and a lot of things.
Okay, hey, tell us a little bit about your book. I mean, where did you come up with the title and what is that, does it mean? I mean, tell our listeners, because, you know, like me, I was fascinated by the book, you know, and I see the title and it draws you in. So why don't you expand on it a little bit and tell everybody about it?
Okay. Now it's like a fever around the world about the 2012. That's based in the Mayan calendar, the end of a period, what they name kins, that are periods of 5,125 years. But Aztecs and Mayans have similar measures for in the calendar. So in the Aztec calendar, the long count, that is like the precession of equinoxes, is of 26,500 years. We split that into periods of four, because for us, the mathematics that repeats constantly in the universe is the four, like four phases of the moon, four elements, two solstices and equinoxes to get one cycle of the earth around the sun. So we split that and we got periods of 6,625 years that we named suns. So now in the 2012 is finishing like a period between the 2012 and 2021 is finishing the fifth sun to enter in the sixth sun. So it's not the end of the world. It's a new period. And that's why the book is named The Dawn of the Sixth Sun.
So it's like the dawn of a new age, like the, you know,
we're a new period.
A new period.
Yeah, like, yeah.
In the book, you kind of described it as a change of seasons.
Yeah.
So what we started in 1991, right? Shifting from the fifth sun to the sixth sun.
And it's all these calendars are like nature. For example, that first is dark in the night, and then quietly light comes, and then it becomes day. Or like the transit into seasons. So the period between 1991 to 2021 is the period of transition. Then the sixth sun will be by its own for a thousand of years. So we're in a special time to live.
So in December 21st, 2012, we're going to be in line with the center of the galaxy.
Yeah, with Milky Way, the sun. So it's a perfect alignment that for us is a very special time, because that day we will have what we call the 8 seconds without time.
And what does that mean, the 8 seconds without time?
I know seconds is a measure of time, but that can be counted with clocks and all the things. But if you think what is time, what is time? Time is our relationship from the Earth to the stars. If we haven't had a sun, it could be impossible to measure night and day. And if we didn't spin, we couldn't measure anything, or we haven't a moon. So it's only our relationship to the stars. That was very known in the ancient Mexico. And they saw that all these planets and stars were surrounding apparently the Earth, or we are surrounding there, creating the illusion of time. So if they align, for us is like being in 8 seconds of no time, where thinking or dreaming and manifestation will collapse. So it will be very special. We will be very careful of what we are doing or thinking or creating, especially in that alignment, and be in consciousness about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one thing when I was reading the book. I just got these pictures of spinning around a Milky Way galaxy and being a part of everything that's around us. One thing when I was thinking about is that the ancients, I mean, they had this knowledge. It almost feels like aliens or something told them, because how could they know exactly how long it took to go around the galaxy and what kind of consciousness we would have in these different sections?
That's the $1 million question. A lot of people ask you, how do you think they did it? even in the oral tradition, that is what I wrote about and what I teach, they say that in the last sun there was a cataclysm. So I think this knowledge comes before the cataclysm. Where did it get? Probably aliens, how you say, or it's a long, because to describe all these cyclical periods, you need at least 25,000 years of observation.
Right.
Well, you know, more to the point, now that we entered into this new season, this new sun, as it were, what does it mean to all of us? How can we capitalize on it? Is there a prophecy? It's going to be great, or it's going to be
great,
or is it going to be like, whoa, you better hold the phone, buddy.
Okay. The chronicle is very clear, the Nahuatl ancient one. It says, the fifth sun will end with earthquakes. There will be a lot of suffering and everyone will die. But that doesn't mean physical death. That's very important. Now it's a complete reality. I began teaching these things many years ago. And now every time that you go to other places, they tell you, in fact, it's shaking all over the world more and more. But what it means that all the old system of the fifth sun is shaking. And if you see politically, economical, religious, everything is shaking all over the world and is changing. That's what it's referring, that everything will change to a new order. So death for us is change.
Okay.
For example, every time we say that the earth dies in winter and gets alive again in spring, so it's death and renewal. So there is a new order that will take. The fifth sun is a sun of light. That doesn't mean good. It means like in the day when you are awake, you are seeing outside. Everything is in the light, your eyes are opened, and God goes outside. The medicine is outside, satisfaction, everything. When you enter into suns of darkness, like the one that is beginning, is a bad thing. It's like closing the eyes, and you have to enter the inner self. Conquest your dream, conquest your caves, your underworld, your unconscious, how it would be seen.
Right. The Tonal Nahu.
Tonal Nahual. Those are the words of the tradition. Tonal, yes, is light, awake. Nahual is who you are, sleeping, and your inner, or spirit. But for us, it's Tonal Nahual. Great.
Yeah, I loved reading Carlos Castaneda growing up, Don Juan, of course. And, he could never describe it. He said that if you try to describe it, you've already lost what it is. But in your book, you seem to kind of get more into it and what it is and the dreaming state. And you just did a workshop before this interview. Maybe you could just talk a little bit more about that, mastering the dream state.
Yeah. I admire very much the work of Carlos Castaneda, too. I think it's very accurate. But it's like I think he took the things that are taught in Mexico and made like kind of a vague novel that is not very clear how to access and all those things. The teachings about dreaming are much more concrete because he calls Nahual to Don Juan and all those things. And in the tradition, the Nahual, everyone is a Nahual because everyone has a sleeping body and okay. Everyone sleeps.
And he described it as like an eggshell with luminous fibers coming off of it.
Yeah, no, everyone has a Nahual. But to become a master in the dreaming and then in the states of sleeping while awake or dreaming while awake, that it's named ensoñación in Spanish, is the mastery of dreams. But there are a lot of concrete ways to get there. For example...
Can you teach that?
Yeah, that's what I do around the world, teaching about dreams and healing and a lot of things, but everything has to be with the Nahual and with the dream state. There are two main, in Mexico, lineages. The one that uses plants, like Castaneda, at least for opening the doors for perception, and the ones that we use breathings. For example, in the lineages of breathings, we are not allowed to take plants. We do everything through our breathing, very intense types of breathing that alter your perception to begin entering in the dreaming state or in states of dreaming while awake.
Okay. That's at the end of the book, too. You have a bunch of exercises.
Yeah.
So anybody who reads the book can go into that and learn more about it and how to do some of these exercises.
Now, do you have a website where people can go to see your schedule?
Of course. Of course. It's www.sergiomagana.com.
All right. Sorry, why don't you spell that out for the listening audience so they know it. Just be in the back of the book.
Okay, that's www.sergiomagana.com.
Perfect.
We invite all of our listeners to go on there and check it out and learn a little bit more about Sergio. And thanks for coming on today, Sergio. It was great talking to you.
Thank you to you, and it's so nice that you like the book. Thank you.
To learn more about Sergio Magana, visit us at our website at justimagining.com.
The Paperboy, a New York Times bestseller and now a major motion picture starring Matthew McConaughey, Nicole Kidman, and John Cusack. The sun was rising over Moat County, Florida, when Sheriff Thurman Call was found on the highway, gutted like an alligator. A local redneck was tried, sentenced, and set to fry. Then Ward James, a hotshot investigative reporter for the Miami Times, returns to his rural hometown with a death row femme fatale, who promises him the story of the decade. She's armed with explosive evidence and aims to free and meet her convicted fiancé.
Once, coming into Fort Lauderdale, we saw the sun. Afterwards, the windows fogged, and I had to wipe them clean with my hand to see. Ward sat still in the seat next to me and made no move to clean the glass in front of him, as if he had no interest in seeing what was outside. He had not wanted to leave his apartment. Helen Drew's story about the Pulitzer Prize was dying then, the way stories always die. It happens when there is nothing to sustain them. But it did not seem to be dying to my brother. It grew, in fact, each day he didn't hear from World War. "I wish this weren't hanging over my head right now," he said. "It isn't as bad as you think. People in Moat County don't care about Miami newspapers or Pulitzer Prizes." It was no comfort. We listened for a while to the sound of the tires and the rain. And then I turned on the radio and heard in a news report that the hurricane had turned east and was headed into the Keys, its winds right at 100 miles an hour. "We ought to stop and get something to drink," he said a little later.
In an eerie and beautiful novel, its secrets continue to reveal themselves long after the book has been finished. New York Times Book Review. A moving and suspenseful novel, The Oregonian. Pete Dexter is the author of the National Book Award-winning novel Paris Trout, among others. He has been a columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News and a Sacramento Bee, and has contributed to many magazines, including Esquire, Sports Illustrated, and Playboy. His screenplays include Rush and Mulholland Falls. Born in Michigan, he was raised in Georgia, Illinois, and eastern South Dakota. He now lives on an island off the coast of Washington. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to blackstoneaudio.com.
Get Behind Me Now, Stay There is a Just Imagine It, Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio, Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Lucia Sherman.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Maya Seligman.
And I'm Charlie Stanton. And we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook. And remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.